This is tape one, side one. A Traveler's Narrative, written to illustrate the episode of the Bab, by Abdu'l-Bahá, translated by Edward G. Brown, a new and corrected edition. Copyright 1980 by the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the United States. Your reader is Bill Peary. Foreword. Among the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, several deal with bibliographical and historical topics. Baha'is are already familiar with memorials of the faithful, sketches of persons who dedicated their lives to Baha'u'lláh, and with The Secret of Divine Civilization, which discusses historical and social problems in Persia, and by extension in the world, in the 19th century. A Traveler's Narrative is even more specifically a history. It details events in the life of the Bab, the founder of the Babi faith, and the prophet herald of the Baha'i faith, and in the lives of his followers, including Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote A Traveler's Narrative, a copy of which was given without indication of authorship to Edward Granville Brown, an English Orientalist who attained Baha'u'llah's presence in 1890. An avid gatherer of Babi and Baha'i manuscripts, Brown had the Persian manuscript and his English translation of it, together with a long introduction and copious footnotes published by Cambridge University Press in 1891. In this edition, we have omitted Brown's introduction and footnotes, aiming at the general reader without making any attempt to provide a scholarly edition. We have made the transliteration of Persian and Arabic words uniform with that used in other Baha'i books. A brief glossary, a few notes, and an index have been added to aid the reader. This book is not divided into chapters. Therefore, I will periodically give the page number so that you will have some feeling as to where you are in the book. The book consists of 94 pages. A Traveler's Narrative, written to illustrate the episode of the Bab, page 3. Touching the individual known as the Bab and the true nature of this sect, diverse tales are on the tongues and in the mouths of men, and various accounts are contained in the pages of Persian history and the leaves of European chronicles. But because of the variety of their assertions and the diversity of their narratives, not one is as worthy of confidence as it should be. Some have loosed their tongues in extreme censure and condemnation. Some foreign chronicles have spoken in a commendatory strain, while a certain section have recorded what they themselves have heard without addressing themselves either to censure or approbation. Now, since these various accounts are recorded in other pages, and since the setting forth thereof would lead to prolixity, therefore what relates to the history of this matter, sought out with the utmost diligence during the time of my travels in all parts of Persia, whether far or near, from those without and those within, from friends and strangers, and that whereon the disputants are agreed, shall be briefly set forth in writing, so that a summary of the facts of the case may be at the disposal of those who are athirst after the fountain of knowledge, and who seek to become acquainted with all events. The Bab was a young merchant of the pure lineage. He was born in the year 1235 A.H., on the first day of Muharram, and when after a few years his father Sayyid Muhammad Rida died, he was brought up in Shiraz in the arms of his maternal uncle Mirza Sayyid Ali, the merchant. On attaining maturity, he engaged in trade in Bushehr, first in the partnership with his maternal uncle, and afterwards independently. On account of what was observed in him, he was noted for godliness, devoutness, virtue, and piety, and was regarded in the sight of men as so characterized. In the year 1260 A.H., when he was in his 25th year, certain signs became apparent in his conduct, behavior, manners, and demeanor, whereby it became evident in Shiraz that he had some conflict in his mind, and some other flight beneath his wing. He began to speak and to declare the rank of Babhood. Now what he intended by the term Bab, gate, was this, that he was the channel of grace from some great person still behind the veil of glory, who was the possessor of countless and boundless perfections, by whose will he moved, and to the bond of whose love he clung. And in the first book which he wrote in explanation of the Surah of Joseph, he addressed himself in all passages to that person, unseen, from whom he received help and grace, sought for aid in the arrangement of his preliminaries, and craved the sacrifice of life in the way of his love. Amongst others is this sentence: O remnant of God, I am wholly sacrificed to thee. I am content with curses in thy way. I crave naught but to be slain in thy love, and God the Supreme sufficeth as an eternal protection. He likewise composed a number of works in explanation and elucidation of the verses of the Quran, of sermons, and of prayers in Arabic, inciting and urging men to expect the appearance of that person, and these books he named Inspired Pages and Word of Conscience. But on investigation it was discovered that he laid no claim to revelation from an angel. Now, since he was noted amongst the people for lack of instruction and education, the circumstance appeared in the sight of men supernatural. Some men inclined to him, but the greater part manifested strong disapproval, whilst all the learned doctors and lawyers of repute who occupied chairs, altars, and pulpits were unanimously agreed on eradication and suppression, save some divines of the Shaykhi party, who were anchorites and recluses, and who, agreeably to their tenets, were ever seeking for some great, incomparable, and trustworthy person, whom they accounted, according to their own terminology, as the fourth support, and the central manifestation of the truths of the precipitous religion. Of this number, Mulla Hussein of Bushri, Mirza Ahmad of Asgan, Mulla Sadiq Mukdakhas the Holy, Sheikh Abul Turab of Ishtahard, Mulla Yusuf of Aridilb, Mulla Jalil of Uramayil, Mulla Madi of Khand, Sheikh Sayyid the Indian, Mulla Ali of Bastam, and the like of these came out unto him, and spread themselves through all parts of Persia. The Bab himself set out to perform the circumambulation of the house of God. On his return, when the news of his arrival at Bushrir reached Shiraz, there was much discussion, and a strange excitement and agitation became apparent in that city. The great majority of the doctors set themselves to repudiate him, decreeing slaughter and destruction, and they induced Hussein Khan Ajudan Bashri, who was the governor of Fars, to inflict a beating on the Bab's missionaries, that is, on Mulla Sadiq Mukdakas, and then, having burnt his mustaches and beard, together with the nose of Mirza Muhammad Ali of Barafurush and Mulla Ali Akbar of Ardistan, they put halters on all three and led them round the streets and bazaars. Now, since the doctors of Persia had no administrative capacity, they thought that violence and interference would cause extinction and silence, and led to suppression and oblivion, whereas interference in matters of conscience causes stability and firmness, and attracts the attention of men's sight and souls, which fact has received experimental proof many times and often. So this punishment caused notoriety, and most men fell to making inquiry. The governor of Fars, acting according to that which the doctors deemed expedient, sent several horsemen, caused the Bab to be brought before him, censured and blamed him in the presence of the doctors and scholars, and loosed his tongue in the demand for reparation. And when the Bab returned his censure and withstood him greatly, at a sign from the president they struck him a violent blow, insulting and contemning him, in such wise that his turban fell from his head, and the mark of the blow was apparent on his face. At the conclusion of the meeting they decided to take counsel, and on receiving bail and surety of his maternal uncle's Haji Sayyid Ali, sent him to his house, forbidding him to hold intercourse with relations or strangers. One day they summoned him to the mosque, urging and constraining him to recant, but he discoursed from the pulpit in such wise as to silence and subdue those present, and to establish and strengthen his followers. It was then supposed that he claimed to be the medium of grace from His Highness the Lord of the Age, upon him be peace. But afterwards it became known and evident that his meaning was the gatehood, Babiat, of another city, and the mediumship of the graces of another person, whose qualities and attributes were contained in his books and treatises. At all events, as has been mentioned, by reason of the doctor's lack of experience and skill in administrative science, and the continual succession of their decisions, comment was rife, and their interference with the Bab cast a clamor throughout Persia, causing increased ardor in friends and the coming forward of a hesitating. For by reason of these occurrences men's interest increased, and in all parts of Persia some of God's servants inclined toward him, until the matter acquired such importance that the late King Muhammad Shah delegated a certain person named Sayyid Yahya of Darab, who was one of the best known of doctors and Sayyids, as well as an object of veneration and confidence, giving him a horse and money for the journey so that he might proceed to Shiraz and personally investigate this matter. When the above-mentioned Sayyid arrived at Shiraz, he interviewed the Bab three times. In the first and second conferences, questioning and answering took place. In the third conference, he requested a commentary on the surah called Karshar, and when the Bab, without thought or reflection, wrote an elaborate commentary on the Karshar in his presence, the above-mentioned Sayyid was charmed and enraptured with him, and straightway, without consideration for the future or anxiety about the results of this affection, hastened to Burajird to his father Sayyid Jafar, known as Kashifi, and acquainted him with the matter. And although he was wise and prudent, and was wont to have regard to the requirements of the time, he wrote without fear or care a detailed account of his observations to Mirza Luft Ali, the chamberlain, in order that the latter might submit it to the notice of the late king, while he himself journeyed to all parts of Persia, and in every town and station summoned the people from the pulpit tops in such wise that other learned doctors decided that he must be mad, accounting it a sure case of bewitchment. Now when the news of the decisions of the doctors and the outcry and clamor of the lawyers reached Zanjan, Mullah Muhammad Ali, the divine, who was a man of mark, possessed of penetrating speech, sent one of those on whom he could rely to Shiraz to investigate this matter. This person, having acquainted himself with the details of these occurrences, in such wise as was necessary and proper, returned with some of the Bab's writings. When the divine heard how matters were, and had made himself acquainted with the writings, notwithstanding that he was a man expert in knowledge and noted for profound research, he went mad and became crazed as was predestined. He gathered up his books in the lecture room, saying, "The season of spring and wine has arrived," and uttered this sentence, "Search for knowledge after reaching the known is culpable." Then from the summit of the pulpit he summoned and directed all of his disciples to embrace the doctrine, and wrote to the Bab his own declaration and confession. The Bab in his reply signified to him the obligation of congregational prayer. Although the doctors of Zanjan arose with heart and soul to exhort and admonish the people, they could effect nothing. Finally, they were compelled to go to Tehran and made their complaint before the late King Muhammad Shah, requesting that Mullah Muhammad Ali might be summoned to Tehran. So the royal order went forth that he should appear. Now when he came to Tehran, they brought him before a conclave of doctors, but, so they relate, after many controversies and disputations, naught was effected with him in that assembly. The late king therefore bestowed on him a staff and 50 tumans for his expenses, and gave him permission to return. At all events, this news being disseminated through all parts and regions of Persia, and several proselytes arriving in Fars, the doctors perceived that the matter had acquired importance, that the power to deal with it had escaped from their hands, and that imprisonment, beating, tormenting, and contumely were fruitless. So they signified to the governor of Fars, Hussein Khan, "If thou desirest the extinction of this fire, or seekest a firm stopper for this rent and disruption, an immediate cure and decisive remedy is to kill the Bab, and the Bab has assembled a great host and meditates arising." So Hussein Khan ordered Abdul Hamid Khan, the high constable, to attack the house of the Bab's maternal uncle at midnight on all sides, and to bring him and all his followers handcuffed. But Abdul Hamid Khan and his hosts found no one in the house save the Bab, his maternal uncle, and Sayyid Qasim of Zanjan. And as it chanced that on that night, the sickness of the plague and the extreme heat of the weather had compelled Hussein Khan to flee, he released the Bab on condition of his quitting the city. On the morning after that night, the Bab with Sayyid Qasim of Zanjan set out for Shiraz for Isfahan. Before reaching Isfahan, he wrote a letter to the Mutamid Dudali, the governor of the province, requesting a lodging in some suitable place with the sanction of the government. The governor appointed the mansion of the Imam Jumhi. There he abode 40 days, and one day, agreeably to the request of the Imam, he wrote without reflection a commentary on the Surah of Val-Ashur before the company. When the news reached the Mu'tamid, he sought an interview with him and questioned him concerning the special mission. At that same interview, an answer proving the special mission was written. The Mu'tamid then gave orders that all the doctors should assemble and dispute with him in one conclave, and that the discussion should be faithfully recorded without alteration by the instrumentality of his private secretary, in order that it might be sent to Tehran, and that whatever the royal edict and decree should ordain might be carried out. The doctors, however, considering this arrangement as a weakening of the law, did not agree, but held a conclave and wrote, "If there be doubt in the matter, there is need of assembly and discussion. But as this person's disagreement with the utmost luminous law is clearer than the sun, therefore the best possible thing is to put in practice the sentence of the law." The Mu'tamid then desired to hold the assembled conference in his own presence, so that the actual truth might be disclosed and hearts be at peace. But these learned doctors and honorable scholars, unwilling to bring the precipitous law into contempt, did not approve discussion and controversy with the young merchant, with the exception of that most erudite sage, Aka Muhammad Mehdi, and that eminent Platonist, Mirza Hassan of Nur. So the conference terminated in questionings on certain points relating to the science of fundamental dogma and the elucidation and analysis of the doctrines of Mulla Sadra. So, as no conclusion was arrived at by the governor from this conference, the severe sentence and harsh decision of the learned doctors was not carried out, but, anxious to abate the great anxiety quickly and prevent a public tumult effectually, he gave currency to a report that a decree that had been issued ordering the Bab to be sent to Tehran in order that some decisive settlement might be arrived at, or that some courageous divine might be able to confute him. Page 10. He accordingly sent him forth from Isfahan with a company of his own mounted bodyguard, but when they reached Muchukar, he gave secret orders for his return to Isfahan, where he afforded him a refuge and asylum in his own roofed private quarters, and not a soul save the confidential and trusty dependents of the Mu'tamid knew aught of the Bab. A period of 4 months passed in this fashion, and the Mu'tamid passed away to the mercy of God. Gurkhan Khan, the Mu'tamid's nephew, was aware of the Bab's being in the private apartments, and represented the matter to the Prime Minister. Haji Mirza Akasi, that celebrated minister, issued a decisive command and gave instructions that they should send the Bab secretly in disguise under the escort of Nusairi horsemen to the capital. When he reached Kinarjird, a fresh order came from the Prime Minister appointing the village of Kulnan as an abode and dwelling place. There he remained for a period of 20 days. After that, the Bab forwarded a letter to the royal presence, craving an audience to set forth the truth of his condition, expecting this to be a means for the attainment of great advantages. The Prime Minister did not admit this, and made representation to the royal presence. The royal cavalcade is on the point of starting, and to engage in such matters as the present will conduce to the disruption of the kingdom. Neither is there any doubt that the most notable doctors of the capital also will behave after the fashion of the doctors of Isfahan, which thing will be the cause of a popular outbreak, or that, according to the religion of the Immaculate Imam, they will regard the blood of the Sayyid as of no account, yea, as more lawful than mother's milk. The imperial train is prepared for travel. Neither is there a hindrance or impediment in view. There is no doubt that the presence of the Bab will be the cause of the gravest trouble and the greatest mischief. Therefore, on the spur of the moment, the wisest plan is this: to place this person in the castle of Maku during the period of absence of the royal train from the seat of the imperial throne, and to defer the obtaining of an audience to the time of return. Agreeably to this view, a letter was issued addressed to the Bab in His Majesty's own writing, and according to the traditional account of the tenor of this letter, the epitome thereof is this, after the titles: "Since the royal train is on the verge of departure from Tehran, to meet in a befitting manner is impossible. Do you go to Maku, and there abide and rest for a while, engaged in praying for our victorious state, and we have arranged that under all circumstances they shall show you attention and respect. When we return from travel, we will summon you specially." After this, they sent him off with several mounted guards, amongst them Muhammad Big, the courier, to Tabriz and Maku. Besides this, the followers of the Bab recount certain messages conveyed from him by the instrumentality of Muhammad Big, amongst which was a promise to heal the foot of the late king, but on condition of an interview and the suppression of the tyranny of the majority, and the prime minister's prevention of the conveyance of these letters to the royal presence. For he himself laid claim to be a spiritual guide, and was prepared to perform the functions of religious directorship, but others denied these accounts. At all events, in the course of the journey, he wrote a letter to the prime minister saying, "You summoned me from Isfahan to meet the doctors and for the attainment of a decisive settlement. What has happened now that this excellent intention has been changed for Maku and Tabriz?" Although he remained 40 days in the city of Tabriz, the learned doctors did not condescend to approach him, and did not deem it right to meet him. Then they sent him off to the castle of Maku, and for 9 months lodged him in the inaccessible castle, which is situated on the summit of that lofty mountain. And Ali Khan of Maku, because of his excessive love for the family of the Prophet, paid him such attention as was possible, and gave permission to some persons to converse with him. Now when the accomplished divines of Adhirbanjan perceived that in all the parts around about Tabriz it was as though the last day had come by reason of the excessive clamor, they requested the government to punish the Bab's followers, and to remove the Bab to the castle of Chirik. So they sent him to that castle, and consigned him to the keeping of Yahya Khan, the Kurd. Glory be to God, notwithstanding these decisions of great doctors and revered lawyers, and severe punishments and reprimands, beatings, banishments, and imprisonments on the part of governors, this sect was daily on the increase, and the discussion and disputation was such that in meetings and assemblies in all parts of Persia there was no conversation but on this topic. Great was the commotion which arose. The doctors of the precipitous religion were lamenting, the common folk clamorous and agitated, and the friends rejoicing and applauding. But the Bab himself attached no importance to this uproar and tumult, and alike on the road and in the castle of Maku and Chirik, evening and morning, nay, day and night, in extremest rapture and amazement, he would restrict himself to repeating and meditating on the qualities and attributes of that absent yet present, regarded and regarding person of his. [Footnote: A reference to Baha'u'llah, him whom God shall make manifest, whose precursor the Bab considered himself to be. Thus he makes a mention of him, whereof this is the purport: "Though the ocean of woe rageth on every side, and the bolts of fate follow in quick succession, and the darkness of griefs and afflictions invade soul and body, yet is my heart brightened by the remembrance of thy countenance, and my soul is as a rose garden from the perfume of thy nature." In short, after he had remained for 3 months in the castle of Chirik, the eminent doctors of Tabriz and scholars of Adhirbanjan wrote to Tehran and demanded a severe punishment in regard to the Bab for the intimidation and frightening of the people. When the prime minister, Haji Mirza Akasi, beheld the ferment and clamor of the learned doctors in all districts of Persia, he perforce became their accomplice, and ordered him to be brought from Chirik to Tabriz. In the cause of his transit by Urmari, the governor of the district, Kazim Mirza, treated him with extraordinary deference, and a strange flocking together of high and low was apparent. These conducted themselves with the utmost respectfulness. When the Bab reached Tabriz, they brought him after some days before the governmental tribunal. Other learned doctors, the Nizamul Ulama, Mullah Muhammad E. Mamakani, Mirza Ahmad the Imam Jami, Mirza Ali Askar the Shakul Islam, and several other divines were present. They asked concerning the claims of the Bab. He advanced the claim on Medihood, whereon a mighty tumult arose. Eminent doctors and overwhelming might compassed him on all sides, and such was the onset of orthodoxy that it had been no great wonder if a mere youth had not withstood the mountain of Elburz. They demanded proof. Without hesitation, he recited texts, saying, "This is the permanent and most mighty proof." They criticized his grammar. He adduced arguments from the Quran, setting forth therefrom instances of similar infractions of the rules of grammar. So the assembly broke up, and the Bab returned to his own dwelling. The heaven-cradled crown prince was at that time governor of Azerbaijan. He pronounced no sentence with regard to the Bab, nor did he desire to interfere with him. The doctors, however, considered it advisable at least to inflict a severe chastisement, and beating was decided on. But none of the corps of farrashes would agree to become the instruments of the infliction of this punishment. So Mirza Ali Ashgar, the Sakhul Islam, who was one of the notable Sayyids, brought him to his own house and applied the rods with his own hand. After this, they sent the Bab back to Shikrik and subjected him to a strict confinement. Now, when the news of this beating, chastisement, imprisonment, and rigor reached all parts of Persia, learned divines and esteemed lawyers who were possessed of power and influence girt up the loins of endeavor for the eradication and suppression of this sect, exerting their utmost efforts therefor. And they wrote notice of their decision, to wit, that this person and his followers are in absolute error and are hurtful to church and state. And since the governors in Persia enjoyed the fullest authority, and in some provinces they followed this decision and united in uprooting and dispersing the Babis. But the late King Muhammad Shah acted with deliberation in this matter, reflecting, "This youth is of the pure lineage, and of the family of him addressed with, were it not for thee. So long as no offensive actions, which are incorruptible with the public peace and well-being, proceed from him, the government should not interfere with him." And whenever the learned doctors appealed to him from the surrounding districts, he either gave no answer or else commanded them to act with deliberation. Notwithstanding this, between eminent doctors and illustrious scholars and those learned persons who were followers of the Bab, opposition, discussion, and strife did so increase that in some provinces they desired to resort to mutual imprecation. And for the governors of the provinces, too, a means of acquiring gain was produced, so that great tumult and disturbance arose. And since the malady of the gout had violently attacked the king's foot and occupied his world-ordering thought, the good judgment of the chief minister, the famous Haji Mirza Akasi, became the pivot of the conduct of affairs, and his incapacity and lack of resource became apparent as the sun. For every hour he formed a new opinion and gave a new order. At one moment he would seek to support the decision of the doctors, accounting the eradication and suppression of the Babis as necessary. At another time he would charge the doctors with aggressiveness, regarding undue interference as contrary to justice. At another time he would become a mystic and say, "All these voices are from the king," or repeat with his tongue, "Moses is at war with Moses," or recite, "This is naught but thy trial." In short, this changeable minister, by reason of his mismanagement of important matters and failure to control and order the affairs of the community, so acted that disturbance and clamor arose from all quarters and directions. The most notable and influential of the doctors ordered the common folk to molest the followers of the Bab, and a general onslaught took place. More especially, when the claim of Midihood reached the hearing of eminent divines and profound doctors, they began to make lamentation and to cry and complain from their pulpits, saying, "One of the essentials of religion and of the authentic traditions transmitted from the holy imams, nay, the chief basis of the foundation of the Church of His Highness Ja'far, is the oculation of the Immaculate Twelfth Imam, upon him be peace. What has happened to Jabulaka? Where has Jabul Sa gone? What is the minor oculation? What has become of the major oculation? What are the sayings of Hussein ibn Ru, and what the tradition of Ibn Mirriyar? What shall we make of the flight of the guardians and the helpers? How shall we deal with the conquest of the east and of the west? Where is the ass of Antichrist? When will the appearance of the Sufyan be? Where are the signs which are in the traditions of the Holy Family? Where is that whereon the victorious church is agreed? The matter is not outside one of two alternatives. Either we must repudiate the traditions of the holy imams, now grow wearied of the church of Ja'far, and account the clear indications of the imam as disturbed dreams, or in accordance with the primary and subsidiary doctrines of the faith and the essential and explicit declarations of the most luminous law, we must consider the repudiation, nay, the destruction of this person as our chief duty. If so be that we shut our eyes to these authentic traditions and obvious doctrines universally admitted, no remnant will endure of the fundamental basis of the Church of the Immaculate Imam. We shall neither be Sunnites, nor shall we be of the prevalent sect to continue awaiting the promised saint and believing in the begotten Mahdi. Otherwise, we must regard as admissible the opening of the gates of saintship and consider that he who is to arise of the family of Muhammad possesses two signs. The first condition, holy lineage. The second, that he is divinely fortified with brilliant verse. What can we do with these thousand-year-old beliefs of the deliberate band of Shiites, or what shall we say concerning their profound doctors and preeminent divines? Were all these in error? Did they journey in the veil of transgression? What an evidently false assertion is this! By God, this is a thing to break the back. O people, extinguish this fire and forget these words. Alas, woe to our faith, woe to our law. Thus did they make complaint in mosques and chapels, in pulpits and congregations. But the Babi chiefs composed treatises against them and set in order replies according to their own thought. Were these to be discussed in detail, it would conduce to prolixity, and our object is the statement of history, not of arguments for believing or rejecting. But some of the replies, that the gist is this, that they held the proof as supreme and the evidence as outweighing traditions, considering the former as the root and the latter as the branch, and saying, if the branch agree not with the root, it serves not as an argument and is unworthy of reliance, for the reported consequence has no right to oppose itself to the established principle and cannot argue against it. Indeed, in such cases, they regarded interpretation as the truth of revelation and the essence of true exegesis. Thus, for instance, they interpreted the sovereignty of the Qayyim as a mystical sovereignty, and his conquests as conquests of the cities of hearts, adducing in support of this the meekness and defeat of the chief of martyrs. May the life of all be a sacrifice for him. For he was the true manifestation of the blessed verse, and verily our host shall overcome for them. Yet, notwithstanding this, he quaffed the cup of martyrdom with perfect meekness, and at the very moment of uttermost defeat, triumphed over his enemies, and became the most mighty of the troops of the supreme host. Similarly, they regarded the numerous writings which, in spite of his lack of education, the Bab had composed, as due to the promptings of the Holy Spirit, extracted from books contrary sayings handed down by men of mark, adduced traditions apparently agreeing with their objects, and clung to the announcements of certain notables of yore. They also considered the conversion of austere and recluse doctors and eminent votaries of the precipitous religion of Islam as a valid proof, deemed the steadfastness and constancy of the Bab as a most mighty sign, and related miracles and the like, which things being altogether foreign to our purpose, we have passed by with brevity, and will now proceed with our original topic. At the time of these events, certain persons appeared amongst the Babis who had a strange ascendancy and appearance in the eyes of this sect. Among these was Mirza Muhammad Ali Amazadaran, who was the disciple of the illustrious Syed, may God exalt his station, Haji Syed Qasim Arasht, and who was the associate and companion of the Bab in his pilgrimage journey. After a while, certain manners and states issued from him, such that all, acting with absolute confidence, considered obedience to him as an impregnable stronghold, so that even Mulla Hussein Abu Rashi, who was the leader of all and the arbiter appealed to alike by the noble and the humble of this sect, used to behave in his presence with great humility and with the self-abasement of a lowly servant. This personage set himself to exalt the words of the Bab with the utmost steadfastness, and the Bab did full justice to speech in praising and glorifying him, accounting his uprising as an assistance from the unseen. In delivery and style he was evident magic, and in firmness and constancy superior to all. At length, in the year A.H. 1265, at the sentence of the chief of lawyers, the Sadiullah Ulama, the chief divine of Barfurush, he yielded his head and surrendered his life amidst extremist clamor and outcry. And amongst them was she who was entitled Karatul Ayin, the daughter of Haji Salih, the sage of Kazvin, the erudite doctor. She, according to what is related, was skilled in diverse arts, amazed the understandings and thoughts of the most eminent masters by her eloquent dissertations on the exegesis and tradition of the Precipicus book, and was a mighty sign in the doctrines of the glorious Sheikh of Asha. At the supreme shrines, she borrowed light on matters divine from the lamp of Kazim, and freely sacrificed her life in the way of the Bab. She discussed and disputed with the doctors and sages, loosing her tongue to establish her doctrine. Such fame did she acquire that most people who were scholars or mystics sought to hear her speech, and were eager to become acquainted with her powers of speculation and deduction. She had a brain full of tumultuous ideas, and thoughts vehement and restless. In many places she triumphed over the contentious, expounding the most subtle questions. When she was imprisoned in the house of Mahmud the Kalantar of Tehran, and the festivities and rejoicing of the wedding were going on, the wives of the city magnates who were present as guests were so charmed with the beauty of her speech that, forgetting the festivities, they gathered round her, diverted by listening to her words from listening to the melodies, and rendered indifferent by witnessing her marvels to the contemplation of the pleasant and novel sights which are incidental to a wedding. In short, in elocution she was the calamity of the age, and in ratiocination the trouble of the world. Of fear or timidity there was no trace in her heart, nor had the admonitions of the kindly disposed any profit or fruit for her. Although she was of such as are damsels meet for the bridal bower, yet she was wrested preeminently from stalwart men, and continued to strain the feet of steadfastness until she yielded up her life at the sentence of the mighty doctors of Tehran. But were we to occupy ourselves with these details, the matter would end in prolixity. While Persia was in this critical state, and the learned doctors perplexed and anxious, when the late Prince Muhammad Shah died, and the throne of sovereignty was adorned with the person of the new monarch, Mirza Taqi Khan Amir Nizam, who was prime minister and chief regent, seized in the grasp of his despotic power the reins of the affairs of the commonwealth, and urged the steed of his ambition into the arena of willfulness and sole possession. This minister was a person devoid of experience, and wanting in consideration for the consequences of actions, bloodthirsty and shameless, and swift and ready to shed blood. Severity and punishing he regarded as wise administration, and harshly entreating, distressing, intimidating, and frightening the people, he considered as a fulcrum for the advancement of the monarchy. And as His Majesty the King was in the prime of youthful years, the minister fell into strange fancies, and sounded the drum of absolutism in the conduct of affairs, on his own decisive resolution, without seeking permission from the royal presence, or taking counsel with prudent statesmen. He issued orders to persecute the Babis, imagining that by overweening force he could eradicate and suppress matters of this nature, and that harshness would bear good fruit, whereas, in fact, to interfere with matters of conscience is simply to give them greater currency and strength. The more you strive to extinguish, the more will the flame be kindled, more especially in matters of faith and religion, which spread and acquire influence so soon as blood is shed, and strongly affect men's hearts. These things have been put to the proof, and the greatest proof is this very transaction. Thus they relate that the possessions of a certain Babi in Kashan were plundered, and his household scattered and dispersed. They stripped him naked and scourged him, defiled his beard, and mounted him face backwards on an ass, and paraded him through the streets and bazaars with the utmost cruelty, to the sound of drums, trumpets, guitars, and tambourines. A certain Gabara, who knew absolutely naught of the world or its denizens, chanced to be seated apart in a corner of a caravanserai. When the clamor of the people rose high, he hastened into the street, and becoming cognizant of the offense and the offender, and the cause of his public disgrace and punishment in full detail, he fell to making search, and that very day entered the society of the Babis, saying, "This very ill usage and public humiliation is a proof of truth, and the very best of arguments. Had it not been thus, it might have been that 1,000 years would have passed ere one like me became informed." At all events, the minister, with the utmost arbitrariness, without receiving any instruction or asking permission, set forth commandments in all directions to punish and chastise the Babis. Governors and magistrates sought a pretext for amassing wealth, and officials a means of acquiring profits. Celebrated doctors from the summits of their pulpits incited men to make a general onslaught. The powers of the religious and the civil law linked hands and strove to eradicate and destroy this people. Now this people had not yet acquired such knowledge as was right and needful of the fundamental principles and hidden doctrines of the Bab's teachings, and did not recognize their duties. Their conceptions and ideas were after the former fashion, and their conduct and behavior in correspondence with ancient usage. The way of approach to the Bab was, moreover, closed, and the flame of trouble visibly blazing on every side. At the decree of the most celebrated of the doctors, the government, and indeed the common people, had, with irresistible power, inaugurated rapine and plunder on all sides, and were engaged in punishing and torturing, killing and despoiling, in order that they might quench this fire and wither these poor souls. In towns where these were but a limited number, all of them with bound hands became food for the sword, while in cities where they were numerous, they arose in self-defense, agreeably to their former beliefs, since it was impossible for them to make inquiry as to their duty, and all doors were closed. In Mazandaran, amongst other places, the peoples of the cities of Barafush, at the command of the chief of the lawyers of the Sadulul Ulama, made a general attack on Mullah Hussein of Barashur and his followers, and slew 6 or 7 persons. They were busy compassing the destruction of the rest also, when Mullah Hussein ordered the Adhan to be sounded, and stretched forth his hand to the sword, whereupon all sought flight, and the nobles and lords, coming before him with the utmost penitence and deference, agreed that he should be permitted to depart. They further sent with them as a guard Kushrar of Kadi Kala, with horsemen and footmen, so that according to the terms of the agreement they might go forth safe and protected from the territory of Mazandaran. When they, being ignorant of the fords and paths, had emerged from the city, Kushrar dispersed his horsemen and footmen, and set them in ambush in the forest of Mazandaran, scattered and separated the Babis in that forest on the road and off the road, and began to hunt them down singly. When the reports of muskets arose on every side, the hidden secret became manifest, and several wanderers and other persons were suddenly slain with bullets. Mullah Hussein ordered the Adhan to be sounded to assemble his scattered followers, while Mirza Lut Ali, the secretary, drew his dagger and ripped open Kushra's vitals. Of Kushra's host, some were slain, and others wandered distractedly over the field of battle. Mullah Hussein quartered his host in a fort near the burial place of Sheikh Tabasi, and being aware of the wishes of the community, relaxed and interrupted the march. This detachment was subsequently further reinforced by Mirza Muhammad Ali of Mazandaran with a number of other persons, so that the garrison of the fort numbered 313 souls. Of these, however, all were not capable of fighting, only 110 persons being prepared for war. Most of them were doctors or students whose companions had been, during their whole life, books and treatises. Yet, in spite of the fact that they were unaccustomed to war or to the blows of shot and sword, 4 times were camps and armies arrayed against them, and they were attacked and hemmed in with cannons, muskets, and bombshells, and on all 4 occasions they inflicted defeat, while the army was completely routed and dispersed. On the occasion of the 4th defeat, Abbas Kuli Khan of Larijan was captain of the forces, and Prince Mehdi Kuli Mirza, commander in the camp. The Khan above mentioned used at nights to conceal and hide himself in the disguise amongst the trees of the forest outside the camp, while during the day he was present in the encampment. The last battle took place at night, and the army was routed. The Babis fired the tents and huts, and became bright as day. The foot of Mullah Hussein's horse caught in a noose, for he was riding, the others being on foot. Abbas Kuli Khan recognized him from the top of a tree afar off, and with his own hand discharged several bullets. At the 3rd shot he threw him from his feet. He was borne by his followers to the fort, and there they buried him. Notwithstanding this event, the troops could not prevail by superior force. At length the prince made a treaty and covenant, and swore by the holy imams, confirming his oath by vows plighted on the glorious Quran to this effect: "You shall not be molested, return to your own places." Since the provisions had for some time been exhausted, so that even the skins and bones of horses naught remained, and they had subsisted for several days on pure water, they agreed. When they arrived at the army, food was prepared for them in a place outside the camp. They were engaged in eating, having laid aside their weapons and armor, when the soldiers fell on them on all sides and slew them. Some have accounted this valor displayed by these people as a thing miraculous, but when a band of men are besieged in some places where all avenues and roads are stopped and all hope of deliverance is cut off, they will assuredly defend themselves desperately and display bravery and courage. This ends side one of tape one, ending on page 24. Please turn the tape for continuation.